I'm Lena Alialora.
This is Scott Fain.
This is Linda Orsonoff.
This is Owen Bastable.
I'm Cicely Rogers.
I'm Lisa Lewis.
I'm Brian Pritchett.
This is Rebecca Nay.
I'm Robert Barncourt.
Volunteer run, community powered. This is the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, environmentalists launch a campaign against liquefied natural gas on the anniversary of the Exxon oil spill. The Justice Department admits to having 3,000 memos relating to torture under the Bush administration. The death of a Tibetan monk sparks protests and increased repression from the Chinese government.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Monday, March 23rd, 2009. I'm Lisa Lewis.
And I'm Eddie Greenlee. On the eve of the 20th anniversary of the Exxon Valdez oil spill, a coalition of dozens of environmental groups has called for federal legislation on the import of liquefied natural gas, LNG. There are currently three terminals proposed for the Oregon coast, which are moving forward despite widespread opposition in the state. KBOO's Jenka Soderberg spoke with Rory Cox of Pacific Environment about the proposed legislation.
Rory, how is your group commemorating the 20th anniversary of the Exxon Valdez oil spill?
One of the things that we've been looking at is the potential for a catastrophe with an LNG tanker potentially coming into one of these proposed LNG terminals that are being sited all around the country. And we have sent a letter to the Senate Energy Committee asking them to return the right of LNG terminal siting back to the states. Currently, the federal government controls that.
And what does this legislation that you're proposing have to do with states' rights?
A few years ago, what happened is the LNG industry got impatient, you could say, with some of these local efforts to not site an LNG terminal in their town. And they went to the federal government, they went to Dick Cheney, and they said, you know, we need some protection from these local rabble-rousers. and what they got from the federal government was a clause in the Energy Policy Act of 2005, which says that the federal government is the lead siting authority for LNG terminals. And as a result of that, that stripped the rights of state governments and local governments to have much of a say in this terminal siting process. And it put quite a strain on communities to where now you have in Oregon a good part of the political establishment is saying that the state doesn't need LNG. There's no reason to site these terminals in the state. It's pitting the governor of Oregon against the federal government. It's placed a high burden on these communities and on states to have to put their resources into fighting the federal government on these matters.
And so what would the legislation actually do if it were passed?
It would repeal the part of the Energy Policy Act that gave the federal government that right. In the case of the LNG terminals in Oregon, it would put the authority of siting those terminals back into the hands of the governor and the state agencies that permit these things.
What about liquefied natural gas? How does it compare to oil as far as the impact that it could have if there were to be a spill?
Sure. It's a completely different. It's natural gas in a liquid form, and it's highly combustible. So if it escapes from a tank and goes into the air, it vaporizes. All it takes is a little spark or a small flame to come into contact with that vaporized cloud, and it could create a huge fireball, which could travel up to 3 miles and pretty much level everything in its path.
Again, I've been speaking with Rory Cox, the California Program Director of Pacific Environment. This is Jenka Soderberg with KBOO News.
The state legislature is looking at revamping Oregon's 38-year-old bottle bill by possibly doubling the nickel deposit. The bill also calls for adding redemption centers in an effort to relax demands on grocery stores and requiring deposits on more containers like sports drinks, juice drinks, bottled coffees, and teas. Supporters say the changes would result in more containers being recycled. Grocery stores and distributor representatives want to delay discussion of the bottle bill additions until 2011 in order to give the return system the time it needs to absorb the current addition of water bottles to the recycling list. A state House committee has begun sorting through amendments of the bill introduced by Governor Ted Kulongoski.
More than 650 people from 45 states attended the Farm Cafeteria Conference in Portland last week. It brought together school administrators, nutrition advocates, and farming interests to promote local buying and healthy eating through school lunch programs. Cable reporter David Rosenfeld filed this report.
The National Farm to School Network consists of more than 2,000 programs in 40 states, all geared at connecting local farms to nearby school districts. Anupama Joshi with the National Farm to School Network at Occidental College said the benefits of the program to children's nutrition have proven true.
Farm to school programs increase fruit and vegetable consumption by, more than one serving per day per child, which is significant, in terms of increasing fruit and vegetable consumption for kids.
Buying local can also benefit the nearby farming interests that might be struggling to compete in a global economy.
Farm to school really for me is the win-win situation, and is also a win-win situation for my background. It's nutrition, but I also am really interested in the marketing aspect for farmers and making sure that the farmers get a fair share of the dollar.
Proof of the economic impact from the farm to school program has been studied as well. In Oregon, 91 schools in Gervais and Portland school districts currently receive grant funding from the Kaiser Permanente grant funds. This pays for 7 cents for every lunch served that's part of the program. Based on a recently released EcoTrust study, the two school districts received more than $66,000 in grant funds, which in turn catalyzed close to $226,000 in local purchasing. This year, school districts hope to pass House Bill 2800 at the state legislature, which would create $22.6 million in funding for similar farm-to-school programs throughout the state. Craig Schreiber is the farm-to-school program manager in Oregon. He explained how the program works in action.
Portland Public Schools needed to find 7,000 ears of corn. They said, hey, Corey, this was back in October. They said, can you help us find this? So I find farms that can provide the corn. And it's not one farm that can provide that amount. Remember, that's the largest district in the state. But then there are other small farms in Eugene, Lane County, in Ashland that we can assist in finding farms and bringing farmers to groups to meet with school people and provide some carrots, provide a box of apples, provide a box of pears and things like that. So, yeah, we need to do a much better job of making sure that each region of Oregon has access to their local farms on every level.
Schreiber said that Oregon is a model for other states because of its diversity in agriculture and its progressive thinking.
All eyes are on Oregon because Oregon is unique in that it has an abundance of product, 260 crops, an abundance of commodity products. You have 26 commodity commissions. Oregon is looked to as being progressive enough, liberal in its thinking enough to want to retool some of the existing programs sponsored by school systems and sponsored by the USDA and rethink, how can we create more local access for foods? And does it make the children healthier? Is it a healthier take? That's a big question that goes around here. Is it better for the economy to buy local? That's another big question that's going around today. And then, our kids. I think a lot of this is about the future and how do we set the buying habits and the eating habits of this generation that's currently going through the school system.
Shauna Evans is a program assistant for Food Security Partners at a Nashville, Tennessee middle school. She said kids in Nashville are definitely going to benefit from what she learned at the 3-day conference.
It's a lot different in Nashville. We are kind of slower moving with some things, but we're really trying to get underway some really good school garden projects, healthy school food projects, really trying to make sure that we've got the healthiest food possible for the kids there.
Yet another benefit of farm to school is when kids get to teach their parents about eating healthy and community gardening, said Joshi from the National Farm to School Network.
There are programs that have kids cook meals and then invite parents to those meals. So, just that interaction between parents and kids with food and growing food, we invite parents over to volunteer in the gardens that we have set up at schools. So I think the parental involvement in the program itself helps them see how they can take it to the next level at the family and the home level as well.
For KBOO Evening News, I'm David Rosenfeld.
The state's unemployment rate, the highest in 26 years, reached 9.8% in February. Last month, Oregon's economy lost about 22,000 jobs. In January, the state lost 13,000 jobs. By February, over 200,000 Oregonians were out of work. Construction employment and manufacturing jobs are down, as are financial activities, professional and business services, and trade, transportation, and utilities. Only two sectors of Oregon's economy have gained jobs during the last year. Government and private education and health services have each accounted for approximately 6,000 jobs.
A UN panel meeting next week is expected to recommend that the world ditch the dollar as reserve currency in favor of a shared basket of currencies. Reuters News Service is reporting that currency specialist Avinash Persaud told a meeting today that they would create a currency like the old European model that was a hard-traded, weighted basket. Persaud, a former currency chief at J.P. Morgan, said the recommendation would be one of several delivered to the United Nations on Wednesday. He said it was a good time to move to a shared reserve currency. Persaud has long agreed that the dollar would give way to the Chinese yuan within decades as a global reserve currency. A shared currency might negate this move, he said, but he believed that China would still like to take on the role.
Union workers at AT&T are giving their leaders the authority to call a strike as part of negotiations for a new contract covering 112,000 employees. Several contracts are covering workers at the phone company's landline division expire on April 4th. AT&T Incorporated is trying to make the employees pay more for their health care, among other concessions. The Communication Workers of America says 88% of members covered by the contracts voted in favor of a possible strike. AT&T spokesman Walt Sharp says the strike authorization is expected and routine at this stage in the negotiations. AT&T is the nation's largest employer of union labor.
In Iraq today, two bombings have killed 34 people. One suicide attack in the northeast Baghdad killed 25 people, primarily Kurds. A second bombing at a West Baghdad bus terminal killed 9 people, wounding 23. The U.S. Department of Defense has confirmed the death of 4,258 U.S. soldiers since the U.S. invaded Iraq in 2003. Multiple studies have estimated over 1 million Iraqis have been killed since the U.S. invasion. The exact number of civilians killed is unknown since neither the U.S. nor Iraqi governments do body counts of civilian casualties in the conflict. You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned for Free Speech Radio News at 5:30, followed by Labor Radio at 6 and Prison Pipeline at 6:30. Tomorrow's weather looks like it's going to be mostly cloudy with a 50% chance of showers, which means a 50% chance of non-showers, and a high near 53.
The current time is 5:14. And now, time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
What is the significance of Saturday's demonstration in...
You know what really gets my goat about AIG shelling out $165 million of our tax dollars to the top executives of the very same division that destroyed the company? Everything, that's what. The arrogance, the greed, the secrecy, the lies, the elitism, the thievery, the weaseling, the numbskull duggery, the inconceivable nincompoopery. Skunk farms don't stink as bad as this scandal. But one particular aspect of it has not received enough attention, and it really rubs me raw. It's the rationalization that was made by AIG CEO and then docilely accepted as truth by Obama's top economic team. Their claim is that since the bonuses were part of the employment contracts of the executives, everyone must now bow down and meekly pay up. Treasury Secretary Timothy Geithner says he'll prevent future AIG bonuses, but alas, he shrugged, the sanctity of the existing contracts must be honored. It would be legally difficult to prevent these contractually mandated payments, he whimpered. Come on, there are amoebas with more backbone than this. There is nothing sacred about a corporate contract. Just ask union members and other workers. CEOs routinely abrogate legal contracts on wages, health care, and pensions for working folks. In fact, just last December, Washington demanded that car companies simply tear up their contracts with the United Auto Workers. Yet suddenly we're to believe that AIG's contracts with these rich, incompetent investment bankers are so sacrosanct that even the President of the United States must stand impotently aside while they rob our public treasury? This is Jim Hightower saying, this is a defining moment on whether the Obamacans have the stuff to stand up to corporate power. They should confiscate these ill-gotten bonuses, then let the recipients sue to get the money back, if they dare.
Today's commentary is underwritten by Wiley & Sons, publisher of Hightower's new book, Swim Against the Current, Even a Dead Fish Can Go with the Flow, now available wherever books are sold.
The U.S. Justice Department has admitted to having over 3,000 documents related to torture under the Bush administration. The admission came in a response to the Freedom of Information Act request filed by the American Civil Liberties Union. The department has come under fire recently for destroying 92 videotapes of suspects being tortured. The new admission reveals that there was a considerable back-and-forth discussion between George Bush's cabinet members and the Justice Department regarding how, when, and for how long to use torture on suspects. The ACLU has called on the new Attorney General, Eric Holder, to appoint a special prosecutor to investigate George W. Bush and his cabinet for war crimes.
President Barack Obama's campaign promise to explore new sources of renewable energy is one element of his budget that is non-negotiable, say administration officials. Standing firm on his energy agenda, Obama planned to make the case today for a budget proposal that invests billions in research designed to reduce climate change and guarantees loans for companies that develop clean energy technologies. Obama has tied his first budget proposal as president to a renewable energy program to help the United States move toward energy independence. In a fact sheet released today, the White House said Obama's meeting with clean energy entrepreneurs and leaders of the research community will outline an energy program that draws on the administration's $787 billion stimulus package. The program allocates $39 billion for the Department of Energy and $20 billion in tax incentives for clean energy. The president is also planning a primetime news conference tomorrow as he pushes for a budget proposal that so far has faced opposition from members of both parties.
The White House is reviewing a finding by the Environmental Protection Agency that global warming is a threat to public health and welfare. The EPA action is the first step to regulating carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases under the Clean Air Act, a move that would have broad economic and environmental impacts. Congressional officials familiar with the EPA's view say the agency's findings were sent to the White House Office of Management and Budget for review. 2 years ago, the Supreme Court said if greenhouse gases are found to endanger public health or welfare, then they must be regulated. But the Bush administration refused to make such a finding. OMB provided no details, but it said it received the EPA document last Friday.
A decision by the South African government to deny the Dalai Lama entry to the country has been widely criticized. The Dalai Lama was expected to attend a conference on football and peace in Johannesburg this Friday, but South African authorities denied him a visa. They said his presence would distract from the issues being discussed. Nobel laureate Desmond Tutu has pulled out of the conference in protest. There's been speculation that South Africa refused the visa in order to protect its relationship with China. The South African government defended its decision, saying the Dalai Lama was not officially invited.
A Tibetan living in India received mobile phone footage from a protest that occurred in their hometown on Saturday. The footage from the small town of Ragya shows a large crowd engaged in protest with their fists in the air. The crowd was chanting the traditional Tibetan rally cry and shouting commonly used Tibetan slogans that were translated as "Victory to Tibet" and "Victory to the Gods." The mobile phone footage is critical as it disproves China's propaganda campaign that it uses to justify its siege of the Tibetan village. KBOO's Rebecca Ney spoke with Ladin Tatan from Students for a Free Tibet.
What is the significance of Saturday's demonstration in Ragya?
I think what we're seeing inside Tibet is just people really pushed to the brink. The Tibetans are living under such intense repression there. And what happened in this incident, a young monk, 28 years old, who was actually in police custody, managed to escape, and he went to the river there, what Tibetans call the Machu, but the Chinese call the Yellow River, and he threw himself in. Now, whether he was trying to escape or whether he was trying to commit suicide, we don't know, but that's sort of the pressure and the desperation you can see in his act. That's what Tibetans are living in right now inside Tibet. And so when the people protested, I guess more than 1,000 Tibetans are reported to have protested. It's a huge number in Tibet in this time when it's basically, Tibet's under de facto martial law. There are troops everywhere. There's a massive military deployment by the Chinese government in Tibet. And even in spite of all of these incredible, overwhelming obstacles to protest and this climate of fear, Tibetans are feeling this desperate. It's not a really populated area either, so to have 1,000 people join in this protest is really significant.
What was the Chinese government's response to this latest protest?
The Chinese government response, as far as we know, is, again, more troops deployed. They surrounded the monastery. 89 to 100 monks have been detained. And the information is really hard to get out at this point because they have shut down phone communications, you know, mobile phone service in the area. We, at this point, Tibetans are so afraid to talk on the phone and tell us what's really happening that it's hard to know exactly what is the real story. But the Chinese themselves, the Chinese state media, has confirmed that the protest happened. They're calling it a riot, and they're saying that because people spread rumors, there was a riot and the Tibetans attacked the police. Well, actually, what we do know is that this young monk, you know, threw himself in the river, and Tibetans reacted in sadness, anger, and frustration over what is a total crackdown on any basic freedoms Tibetans may have even had in the past in Tibet, and a total denial of Tibetans' basic fundamental rights at this moment, which is already sensitive for Tibetans because this is, of course, March 2009 marks 50 years that Tibetans have been under Chinese rule and since the Dalai Lama fled into exile in India.
How can countries like the United States affect change in how the Chinese government deals with Tibet?
Tibet is a pressure issue. Anybody who's watched China over all these years knows that they do respond to pressure. The Chinese government wants to act like they don't care, you know, that they are not going to change their ways, but they do. Whether it's President Obama, Hillary Clinton, or, you know, even a local congressman or senator, for our political leadership to speak out on this issue, on the issue of human rights and freedoms in Tibet, actually makes the Chinese government check themselves in this way or that way in Tibet. And really, that could mean life and death inside Tibet.
I've been speaking with Ladun Tathong, who is a representative for Students for a Free Tibet. This is Rebecca Ney with the KBOO Evening News.
Even as Pope Benedict XVI said today his heart cannot be at peace while people are homeless, critics used his Africa pilgrimage to highlight the plight of thousands violently evicted from land owned by the Catholic Church. Amnesty International appealed to Benedict during his visit to the Southern Africa country to press its government for full compensation for the families who have been forced from church land since 2004. More than 2,000 families have been evicted since Angola began returning land to the church that had been seized by the former Marxist state, according to Maluka Miti, a researcher for Amnesty International. The London-based human rights group said people were detained and arrested arbitrarily and subjected to torture in some cases.
Israel's military condemned its soldiers for wearing T-shirts showing a pregnant woman in a rifle's crosshairs with the slogan, "One shot, two kills." Also condemned was another of a gun-toting child with the words, "The smaller they are, the harder it is." The T-shirts were worn by Israeli soldiers to mark the end of basic training and other military courses, the newspaper Haaretz said. Israel's military has come under increasing scrutiny after soldiers alleged that some troops opened fire hastily and killed Palestinian civilians, including children, during the Gaza War, possibly because they believed they would not be held accountable under relaxed open fire regulations. UN human rights experts said today that Israeli soldiers used an 11-year-old Palestinian boy as a human shield during the Gaza offensive.
The parents of a man severely wounded by Israeli troops during a West Bank protest have asked Israeli police to launch an investigation. KBOO's Crystal Leedy has more.
Jonathan, we're concerned about the condition of Tristan Anderson. We know that his parents have asked their lawyer to have the Israelis investigate this. There was a meeting today that you went to, is that right?
There was a press conference today in which the parents, Tristan's parents and his lawyer expressed their demand that Israel takes full responsibility for what Tristan, for what happened to Tristan. And this starts with opening an independent investigation. Right now, the situation is that the army is investigating itself. The least that should happen is that the Israeli police starts a criminal investigation into the matter. We have to remember that what happened is that a demonstrator that the army itself says posed no threat to the soldiers was shot with a tear gas projectile and is left in critical condition even today, more than a week after the incident.
Do you have any hope that this press conference will get some action going?
We were hoping that the media attention will help us put some pressure on the American administration to pressure the Israelis into doing that. Israel has a tendency to use army investigation, internal investigations, as whitewash, as presenting a facade of investigating the situation while actually doing nothing. We are hoping that the press conference, together with the joint by the complaint that the family's lawyer had filed today, will force the Israelis to launch an investigation. If that will not happen, we have a few more steps available to us that we intend on pursuing, including petitioning to the Israeli Supreme Court if needed. This will not, however, require the shooting of an unarmed civilian during a demonstration.
Okay, thank you very much for this update on what is happening for Tristan Anderson. For KB Evening News, this is Crystal Leedy.
Now, it's time for the latest news and developments from the occupied territories in Palestine from the International Middle East Media Center in Bethlehem.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center, www.imemc.org, for Monday, March 23, 2009. Patients die in Gaza due to the continued siege while Israeli police invade a press conference in Jerusalem, attacking journalists. These stories and more coming up. Stay tuned. The Palestinian Ministry of Health in Gaza Strip reported on Sunday that three patients died in Gaza hospitals after being barred from leaving the area for medical treatment abroad, adding that the number of patients who have died due to the siege has now reached 311. The ministry reported that three patients died on Sunday due to the Israeli siege and Egyptian insistence of keeping the Rafah border terminal closed. Meanwhile, on Monday, in the West Bank, during Israeli police forces crackdown on an activity organized in East Jerusalem on Monday afternoon to celebrate Jerusalem's capital of Arab culture 2009, five were injured and eight kidnapped. The activity was a press conference to announce events planned for the rest of this year. Following the Israeli Interior Ministry announcement on Friday that it will stop all the events from taking place in Jerusalem City and arrest anyone who takes part in it. Rima Awad, a local organizer, was there when the police attacked.
This is a typical behavior of the Israeli occupation authorities in Jerusalem. The media people were here, everybody was here, and the press conference was about to start when the police attacked the protest tent. Arrested eight people, closed the press conference down, and physically assaulted members of the civil society activists as well as media people.
The commemorative event, entitled Jerusalem, the Capital of Arab Culture 2009, began on Saturday in the nearby Bethlehem City. The Israeli authorities refused to allow the program of events that was scheduled to be held in Jerusalem, but a pre-recorded program of events was shown on satellite in the conference place of Bethlehem. Elsewhere, during early morning invasions targeting several West Bank areas, the Israeli military kidnapped 7 Palestinian civilians on Monday, local sources reported. In Hebron City in the southern West Bank, Israeli troops searched and ransacked a number of homes in the city and nearby village, kidnapping 4 men. Witnesses said that Israeli troops beat up 4 different men during the home search in the city. Meanwhile, another 3 men were kidnapped when Israeli troops searched homes in Jericho City. Thank you for joining us from Occupied Bethlehem. You have been listening to Palestine Today from the International Middle East Media Center, www.imemc.org. This report has been brought to you by Ghassan Barnoura.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we are open to your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Kendall Archer, Crystal Lady, and Rebecca Nay. Special thanks to reporter David Rosenfeld. Our engineer is Jeff Butterhooks Lovell. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Jenka Soderberg. Podcast local stories from this newscast is available on the KBOO website at kboo.fm. You are listening to KBOO at 90.7 FM in Portland, in Corvallis at 100.7 FM on translator K264AA, and in Hood River at 91.9 FM on translator K220HR. I'm Lisa Lewis.
And I'm Eddie Greenlee. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO. At 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, it's Call-In Talk Radio with Abe Proctor and Joe Uris. At 9, on Political Perspectives with Linda Olsen Osterlund, speaks with journalist and historian Andy Worthington, author of the Guantanamo Files, the stories of the 759 detainees in America's illegal prison, about the first definitive Guantanamo prisoner list. At 9:30, host Emily Young interviews Joel Berg, author of All You Can Eat, How Hungry Is America?, a critique of politicians, the media, and the food industry. At 10, it's Air Cascadia News and Commentary with Chris Andre and Liam Delta. At 10:15, hear Flashpoints, investigative news radio with host Dennis Bernstein. At 11, on stage and studio, Dime Roberts welcomes guests from Northwest Children's Theater's production of Goodnight Moon. And producer Frank Reynolds talks to people around Portland about funding for the arts and the importance of culture in tough economic times. And at 11:30, on Art Focus, host Eva Lake interviews Vanessa Renwick about her new show at the New American Art Union. Renwick works in experimental and poetic documentary forms and produces films, videos, and installations that explore the possibility of hope in contemporary society. Stay tuned now for more national and international news from the worker-run collective at Free Speech Radio News.
Before we go to Free Speech Radio News, we'd like to play the interview from Friday's Democracy Now! With Dr. Izzaldin Abu-Aish in its entirety. We apologize for that interview being cut off on Friday.
Dr. Izzaldin Abu-Aish is a well-known Gazan gynecologist, peace advocate, who's worked in Israeli hospitals for several years. He speaks fluent Hebrew, and during the war, he was a rare Palestinian voice on Israeli television and radio, giving daily accounts of life and death inside Gaza. Democracy Now! Producer Anjali Kamat narrates the exchange that took place live on Israeli television a day and a half before the official end of what the Israelis called Operation Cast Lead.
On January 16th, when Dr. Abu-Aish called Shlomi Eldar of Israel's Channel 10 TV News, Israeli tank shells had just struck his home. They killed his family, he says. I think I'm a bit overwhelmed too. He explains that Dr. Abu-Aish is a physician at Tel HaShomer Hospital. He always feared his family would be hurt. His daughters were injured.
Ya Rabbi!
I want to save them, but they died on the spot, Shlomi. They were hit in the head. A visibly emotional Eldar explains that the doctor had unsuccessfully tried to get out for many days and was afraid to even raise a white flag. A shell hit his home, Eldar says, and I have to tell you, I do not know how to hang up this phone. I will not hang up this phone call. The anchor calls in the Israeli Defense Forces to allow ambulances to get to the doctor's family. Shlomi Eldar then excused himself from the show, took off his earpiece, and rushed off the set to get help to Dr. Aboulesh.
But the ambulances never reached the doctor's home, which was surrounded by Israeli tanks. It was too late to save his three daughters, 21-year-old Bassan, 15-year-old Mayar, and 13-year-old Aya, as well as his niece, Noor, who was age 14. They were all killed instantly by the shells.
The family says they walked a quarter of a mile carrying the dead and wounded through the streets until they found an ambulance that took them to the closest hospital and then to the Erez crossing with Israel. Emergency vehicles organized by Israeli TV correspondent Shlomi Eldar awaited them at the border and took the doctor and his badly wounded 16-year-old daughter, Shada, to the Sheba Medical Center in Tel Aviv.
2 months after the tragedy, Democracy Now! Producer Anjali Kamet and Jackie Suin of Big Noise Films visited Dr. Aboulaish at his home in Jabalia, Gaza. He pointed out the remnants from that fateful day. Blood-stained walls, books, clothes, and hand-drawn pictures, gaping holes that were once windows, burned-out bits of computers, twisted pieces of metal, destroyed cupboards, shattered glass, and shrapnel. He told a story late Monday night to Anjali Kamet as he walked through his daughter's room.
We are standing in the scene of the tragedy, in the place where four lovely girls were sitting, building their dreams and their hopes. And in second, these dreams were killed. These flowers were dead. Three of my daughters and one niece were killed in 1 second. On the 16th of January, at a quarter to 5 p.m., just a few seconds, I left them. And they stayed in the room. Two daughters here, one daughter here, one daughter here, and my niece with them. The first shell came from the tank's base, which is there, came to shell two daughters who were sitting here on their chairs. And when I heard this shell, I came inside the room to find, to look. I can't recognize my daughters. Their heads were cut of their bodies. They were separated from their bodies, and they can't recognize whose body is this. They were drowning in a pool of blood. This is the pool of blood. Even look here. This is their brain. These are parts of their brain. Aya was lying on the ground. Shada was injured, and her eye is coming out. Her fingers were torn, just attached by tag of skin. Felt clubbed, out of space, screaming, what can I do? they were not satisfied by the first shell, and to leave my eldest daughter. But the second shell soon came to kill Aya, to injure my niece who came down from the third floor, and to kill my eldest daughter Bisan, who was in the kitchen and came at that moment screaming and jumping, "My dad, dad, Aya is injured." The second shell, it penetrated the wall between this room to enter the other room. Look, this is the room where the weapons, where this room was fully equipped with weapons. These are the weapons which were in this room. These are the weapons. These are the weapons, the box and their clothes. These were Bisan's handouts. Here you see, these are her handouts for the courses that she studies, which is stained with her blood. It's mixed with her blood. These are the box, these are the weapons that I equipped my daughters with education, with knowledge, with the dreams, with hopes, with love. I am the gynecologist who practiced most of my time in Israel. I was trained in Israel, and I devoted my life and my work for the benefit of humanity and well-being, to serve patients, not as someone else that you are delivering or helping you. I am dealing with patients and the human being. We treat patients equally, with respect, with dignity, with the privacy. Politicians and leaders should learn from doctors these values and these norms and to adopt them.
Have you received an official response from Israel about why your home was targeted, about why your daughters were killed?
What I received, that they admitted their responsibility about shelling my house and killing my daughters and my niece. That's what I received, but others, the reasons behind that, you can ask them. They justified something which is not convincing, and it has many criticisms.
What did they say?
You know, they said they think there were snipers on the roof of my building. It's important to say the truth, and the truth lies here. Only innocent civilian girls were in this room and this building and this surrounding. Nothing else.
Doctor, you're going to be traveling to the United States in a few weeks. What's your message to the government of the United States, to the people of the United States?
To judge things by two eyes, and that the coin has two sides, and that there is a nation, a Palestinian people in Gaza, who are waiting to get their rights and their chance of living equally as every nation in the world. And it's important for the Obama's administration to take the Israeli-Arab file seriously and to deal with it seriously as soon as possible, because it's a matter of saving lives. There is no need for delay. It's important to start solving with the minimum justice. That's what are we looking for. Respect to human rights, equality, dignity, and justice. And what they like for themselves, I want Mr. Obama to put himself in the position of the Palestinians and to defend the rights of the Palestinians as he is in the possession of the Israelis. This is my art book. This is the math book. Mayar, who was 15 years old in grade 9, who was dreaming to be a doctor,
and was happy that she will follow the same path as me. Mayar, she was the chairman of the students' parliament at the school. She was elected. She was brilliant in mathematics, so genius. Even when I went to the school to see her friends, still they are remembering Mayar. Yes. This is Aya. This is Aya's notebook. Look. Well, what is saying? Excellent. God bless you. Well organized. This is what is written by her teacher. Was dreaming to be a journalist. She was outspoken. She was very lovely, very beautiful girl. Bisan is a special girl. Not for me, for her uncles, for everyone who knew Bisan. She was 21 years old. She was about to graduate and get her BA from the Islamic University. She was a special girl. So humble, so wise, so beautiful. What can I say about my daughters? It's living with me, it's part of me. I smell them, I taste them, I speak with them. When I'm speaking with you, I am speaking with my daughters. These are the good memories of my daughters, and it will follow me the whole of my life. And I will do my best this memory to be changed into positive actions. To establish a foundation under their name for only girls, to empower girls and women who will achieve and see in these girls the dreams of my daughters. You know, this invasion from the beginning, I said it's useless, it's a futile, no one is winning. The innocent civilians, the Gazans, civilians paid the price of this invasion. No one else. And even the IDF, when they came here, the Israeli government, they said, we want to teach the Gazans a lesson. As if the Gazans are lacking teaching or education. Really, they succeeded in that, in educating the Palestinians, the Gazans, especially a lesson about strengthening animosity, hatredness, bloodshed, and widening the gap between the two people in both sides. This is the only lesson, this is the only outcome of this invasion. Nothing else. Anyone who is saying anything else apart from that, he is lying. Military ways proved its failure. We should look for other ways to give each other its rights. We don't want to speak about peace. Peace is, you know, this word lost its meaning. We should find something else. Respect, equality, justice, and partnership. That's what we should look for.
Dr. Abu Elaish, Palestinian gynecologist and peace advocate. He was speaking with Democracy Now! Producer Anjali Kamat and Jackie Suin of Big Noise Films, who both visited him in his home in Jabalia, Gaza, where Israeli shells killed three of his daughters and a niece 2 months ago.
And that was an interview with Izzaydin Abu Alayish in Gaza. We apologize again for cutting that off on Friday. And that was the full interview that was aired on Democracy Now! We go now to the worker-run collective of Free Speech Radio News for national and international news. Stay tuned at 6 for Labor Radio.
From Pacifica Station KPFK in Los Angeles, this is Free Speech Radio News. It's Monday, the 23rd of March, 2009. I'm Nell Abram with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. A federal judge ruled today that the Food and Drug Administration must allow 17-year-old girls to use Plan B contraception. Judge Edward Corman said that the FDA played politics during past years when it denied emergency contraceptive services to underage girls before its own scientists had completed reviewing the matter. The Ann Arbor News announced today that they'll print their last paper in July. After 174 years, the News will become a web-only outlet. Just a week ago, the Hearst Corporation stopped printing the Seattle Post-Intelligencer, opting for internet-only distribution instead. Also today, Gannett Publishing announced that they will require most workers to take another week of unpaid leave in an attempt to stave off layoffs. It's the second time this year employees have been furloughed. The Service Employees International Union just got even bigger. Some 150,000 Unite Here members who splintered from the union have formed a new group and will affiliate with the SEIU. That brings the SEIU to almost 2.25 million workers. Unite Here formed about 5 years ago when two small unions merged, but after months of discord, the group divided its 400,000-strong membership. The dissidents from Unite Here are forming a new union, Workers United. Unite Here's leader John Wilhelm is fighting the move, citing that the union's constitution bars members from leaving. Wilhelm is challenging the split in court. For Free Speech Radio News from WMNF Community Radio in Tampa, I'm Nell Abram.
A group of independent human rights experts is calling for accountability in Israel's recent attack on Gaza, which killed nearly 1,500 people, wounded some 6,000, and made an estimated 80,000 homeless. The group released a 43-page report today outlining atrocities committed during the three-week-long conflict. The UN's Oliver De Schutter is one of the report's authors.
Although our joint report focuses on the effects on human rights of Palestinians, of the large-scale Israeli military operation launched on 27th of December 2008 in response to rockets fired from the Gaza Strip targeting southern Israel, we have found that the general situation of human rights in the Gaza Strip was of serious concern well before these events, and particularly for some 18 months prior to the escalation of violence, in large part due to the blockade imposed on the Gaza Strip since the Hamas seized power in the Gaza Strip in June 2007.
De Schutter suggests that major human rights violations may have occurred. In one incident documented in the report, an 11-year-old boy was used as a human shield by Israeli soldiers. Meanwhile, in the West Bank, Israeli police forces cracked down on an Arab cultural event. Several were arrested. FSRN's Hassan Banoura reports.
The Israeli Interior Ministry announced on Friday that it would stop the Arab cultural event from taking place in Jerusalem City and arrest anyone who took part in it. But organizers vowed to continue with their cultural festivities and held a press conference Monday to announce that the events would go on. Local organizer Rima Awad was there when the Israeli police attacked.
This is typical behavior of the Israeli occupation authorities in Jerusalem. The media people were here, everybody was here, and the press conference was about to start when the police attacked the protest tent, arrested 8 people, closed the press conference down, and physically assaulted members of the civil society activists as well as media people.
The commemorative event, titled Jerusalem, the Capital of Arab Culture 2009, began Saturday in the nearby Bethlehem City. The Israeli authorities refused to allow the scheduled program of events to be held in Jerusalem, but a pre-recorded program of events was shown via satellite in the Conference Palace of Bethlehem. Other similar events took place in Lebanon, Gaza, and Nazareth, which was linked to the main event in Bethlehem via satellite. Palestinians demand East Jerusalem as the capital of any future Palestinian state. Jerusalem follows Damascus as the capital of Arab culture, a title that has been handed to a different city by the Arab League every year since 1996. Winners typically use the occasion to highlight Arab culture, sponsoring poetry, music, dance performances, lectures, school activities, and sporting events. During his opening speech at the event on Saturday, the Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas criticized Israel's policies in Jerusalem.
The policies of discrimination, oppression, and destruction of neighborhoods and homes must all stop for peace to have a chance in this land.
This week, Israel has handed out 80 new demolishing orders to homes owned by Palestinians in Jerusalem City. The Israeli government has intensified its campaign of demolition of Palestinian-owned homes. The Jerusalem municipality handed out demolishing orders to 96 Palestinian families in the first week of March alone, while another 88 such orders were handed out in February. Since Israel occupied the city of Jerusalem in 1967, the authorities have rarely given Palestinian residents permission to build homes. The Israeli government has continued to build Jewish settlements in and around Jerusalem, an act which violates international law. For Afasaran and IMEMC.org, this is Ghassan Barnoura.
Anti-war activists marked the sixth anniversary of the start of the Iraq War with protests in several major cities throughout the United States. Demonstrations weren't as numerous or as large as in years past, but a continuing peace movement sent a message to the Obama administration to change U.S. military policies, from sending more troops to Afghanistan to selling weapons and beyond. Today, we bring you sounds from two of these protests taking place on opposite sides of the country. Africa Jones and Karen Miller report.
Thousands in D.C. marched to the Pentagon this weekend to protest the sixth anniversary of the war in Iraq. The protesters, some carrying mock coffins draped with flags, came to express their frustration with President Obama. Myra Pleno traveled to D.C. from Providence, Rhode Island.
He's just taking people out of Iraq and putting them in Afghanistan.
The Obama administration is increasing troops in Afghanistan and will continue to have troops in Iraq until 2011. In addition to the war, protesters also rallied against racism, the oppression happening in Palestine, and violence against women. Michael Matabanazzo is from Zimbabwe. He wore an orange jumpsuit signifying Guantanamo prisoners. He says what happens in the U.S. affects the rest of the world.
We cannot be free in Africa, Asia, until the people here are free. Okay? Minorities, women, and prisoners are treated properly.
In addition to marching to the Pentagon, the protests went by contractors Boeing, Lockheed Martin, General Dynamics, and KBR. Mary Grace from Madison, Virginia, has been attending protests since 1976.
I'm a grandma now, and I raised my kids believing that the way to respond to others who are angry or being rude or hurtful or mean to you is with love, and that's the only way that we can ever change things.
Police showed up in full riot gear for the protest. No arrests were made. Karen Miller, FSRN, Washington.
Occupation is a crime!
This is Africa Jones in San Francisco, where around 1,000 people gathered downtown on Saturday for a rally in March.
The central theme of this rally is occupation is a crime. Iraq, Afghanistan, Palestine. Should we include all three and say U.S. out now?
Dissatisfaction over the recent bailouts were also a concern. John Barth attended the rally holding a sign saying no bank bailouts.
My daughter just turned 5, and they're defunding the public schools in Berkeley, and so I'm beside myself. All the money that they're pouring down the drain trying to bail out these banks.
Pro-Palestinian sentiments were also a strong component at the rally. Rafael Kadaris was one of the many protesters wearing a black and white checkered keffiyeh, a traditional Palestinian scarf.
Israel
Israeli massacre in Gaza is still continuing in the sense that the Palestinians in Gaza are still living in prison-like conditions.
Protesters were met by counter-protest groups supporting Israel. Along the march, scuffles with police reportedly resulted in 5 arrests. Africa Jones, FSRN.
And that wraps it up for today's newscast. You've been listening to FSRN, which is supported by Pacifica Radio, community radio affiliate stations, and you.
The time is 6 o'clock, and you are listening to KBOO Portland. Stay tuned for Labor Radio. Tonight's host, Jamie Partridge, will interview Donna Hammond about the black struggle in the building trades. Coming up next, Labor Radio.
This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Teamsters Local 206, helping Oregon's working families fight for good jobs and a better future. For information about how the Teamsters can help you win respect at work, the number is 503-251-2344.
This program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from AFSCME Local 88, protecting worker rights and fighting to improve the wages and working conditions of members who work for Multnomah County, Central City Concern, Transition Projects, and American Friends Service Committee. More information at 503-239-9858 or www.local88.ws.
This KBOO program has been made possible in part by SEIU Local 503 OPEU, whose mission is to improve the quality of life through worker empowerment and a progressive labor movement, and whose members deliver quality public services to Oregonians every day.
Listen up. We've got a war zone here today, right in our heartland. And across the USA, these multinational bastards don't use tanks and guns, it's true. But they've declared a war on us, my back, it's up to you. Oh, it's a war on the workers.
War on the workers.
Oh, it's a war on the workers.
War on the workers. Oh,
good evening, and welcome to Labor Radio, KBOO, streaming live at KBOO.FM. This is Jamie Partridge, your host tonight, and a proud member of the National Association of Letter Carriers, Branch 82, and pleased to be delivering your mail, the people's mail, on a daily basis. With me tonight, our guest is Donna Hammond, Sister Donna Hammond, who is a proud member of the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers, Local 48, or should I say International Bunch of Electrical Workers.
Thank you, Jamie.
Yes. Good evening, Donna. Donna is a journeywoman electrician.
Mm-hmm.
Been a member of the trade for 30 years.
Mm-hmm.
And is a early member of the African American Caucus of IBEW Local 48. And I want to ask you, Donna, about why in the world you decided to become an electrician back in the 70s. But before we do, just to backtrack a little bit about the history of black people in the trades in Portland. Back during World War II, tens of thousands of black folks came to Portland to work in the shipyards, and the whites-only unions excluded black people from the unions, and black people were actually relegated to the laborer jobs only. Fast forward to the Civil Rights Movement and the Black Power, Black Freedom Movement in the 60s and 70s, there were federal edicts that came down that really opened up the trade unions and the building and construction trades to black folks. The topic this today, black struggle in the trades, affirmative action, of minority set-asides, started opening up the trades. So, Donna, why don't you tell us about your experience starting in 1978? Why did you want to become an electrician?
That's a good question. I wanted to get into the trades because I have been raised by working class parents who were active in their unions. Mm-hmm. And they told me that I could be and do anything that I wanted to be or do. And my dad said I could do anything that I wanted, but I didn't want to be a machinist. So one day I just happened into the apprenticeship division, and I had an aha moment. One of those moments that you just feel good about. And I had an opportunity to choose between a machinist or an electrical trade, and I chose the electrical.
Mm-hmm. And what kind of help did you need to get in?
Well, I knew nothing about apprenticeship, and I was accepted in 1979, which was a year after an executive order had been signed. And so there were opportunities at the Urban League to help people that looked like me get into the trades.
And what was that executive order?
It was Executive Order 11246 that was signed in 1964 by President Johnson, and then Carter signed an addition to that order in 1978. And I was accepted into the trade in 1978 and started working in January of 1979.
So what kind of difficulties did you encounter trying to get in and trying to stay in?
You know, I think my story is a little different from most people because I had a strong math and science background. And my first summer from college, I had worked as a garage man, and this was another aha moment when they gave me a pair of coveralls, a coverall that said Donna on them. And I lubed an oil, changed tires, and I just really enjoyed working with my hands. And I didn't know how much that was going to serve me until I sat into that interview process. When I could tell them, they saw my aptitude, that I had a strong math and science background, then I had demonstrated that I could work in the industry. Then I told them something else. My earlier years, I had become a tailor. And those same skills that you use in sewing and cutting a pattern and designing are those same spatial skills that you need for blueprint reading. Mm-hmm. And so I shared that with them. So I did. I managed to get in on my first attempt into the trades.
So you had some family encouragement, and you had some, you had parents that had union background, knew something about unions, and you had seen a little bit about the building construction trades. So you had that, but how did you get in?
Well, the Urban League, actually, they helped prepare us for the aptitude test. They had they gave us drills for the manual dexterity exam. We had mock interviews. There were people that were there to help guide us through the process. I had no idea what I was getting into. I was given a mentor, someone that I could talk to explain the process. And then when I started this process was when I found out that I was actually following in my grandmother's footsteps. That my grandmother was a welder's helper during the shipbuilding days down at the Kaiser Yard.
So the Urban League and the black community in general knew that there were going to be some difficulties getting into a trade that was basically white men. And so they prepared you for that. They got behind this new wave of young black people that were going into the trades.
You know, they prepared me as well as they could, Jamie, but they couldn't prepare me for what I went through every day on the job.
Tell me about that.
Jamie, and there were days when I swore that I would not go back to work. I mean, the hostility was, you know, when you go somewhere and you just know that you're not wanted, and or I would go, some days I went home in tears and swore that I would not go back to work. But then I had parents who said, you know, you're doing exactly what they want you to do. They don't want you to come back. But I had more good days than bad days. And I had some brothers who would tell me, you know, you were given an opportunity to be an electrician, and we're going to ensure that you're the best electrician that you want to be. and we're going to train you. So I did. So I coupled that because I had some good brothers, then I had those other brothers that we don't need to talk about right now.
Mm-hmm. So most traditionally in the good old boy network within mm-hmm. the trades, a young person will get in through their brother or their father or their uncle who's been in the trade and who lets them know what's going to be like, and once they're on the job, gives them advice and helps them through on a daily basis. What kind of support did you have on the inside when you say you had some brothers?
Well, I had brothers who would, and I'm talking about good old boy brothers, right?
Are we talking
the same brothers?
Oh, okay.
No, I'm talking
about
the white guys.
All right.
The white guys who would say, would explain, take the time to explain the job to me, to, you know, the difference between an apprentice and a journeyman is who is going to take the lead on the job, right? So I worked with men who said, we're going to play the apprentice and we want you to be the journeyman. And they coached me. We'd be on a project and they would let me take the lead, figure out the jobs. If I was going down the wrong path, they would navigate. Donna, maybe you should consider this. I worked with some extremely knowledgeable journeymen
mm-hmm.
who taught me some really good skills.
You're listening. We're listening to KBOO. This is Labor Radio. The topic tonight is the black struggle in the trades. That's the building and construction trades. Our guest is Donna Hammond. Donna, you were one of the early members of the African-American Caucus, now known as the Minority Caucus within IBEW, Local 48. Tell us about that.
Well, we had an opportunity to help other members of our community get into the trades. Earlier you mentioned about the father, brother. There's a philosophy that nepotism is a good thing. And I believe that. But I don't believe that that's the only reason why you should get into the trades. So one of the things that we did with our caucus is we surveyed what made a successful electrician. We talked to all of the brothers and sisters and to find out what were those inherent skills or information that you needed to know to be a good electrician. So we packaged that. And we took it on the road, and we started sharing that information with other members or other folks who wanted to come in and be like us. So you didn't have to have a brother, sister, mother, father, because we could show you. We could tell you what it meant to be laid off, or what the cyclical nature of this occupation, this career path, what it means to go on the road and travel, become a tramp. Some of the language, you know, that is inherent, you know, when you go to Rome, because this is a different culture. And a lot of people want to make it be like going down and applying for a job and getting hired in a week or two or a month. It's different. It's very different.
So this caucus still exists today, right?
It's
been going on for 30 years.
Mm-hmm.
And during that time, you've been doing quite a bit to help recruit and mentor and get black folks in and help them stay in the electrical and other trades. You were a building trades liaison working with the Private Industry Council
mm-hmm.
in partnership with the Columbia Pacific Building and Construction Trades Council in the early 90s, and you were a program manager for the Infrastructure for the Pathways to Success. Well, that's the Oregon Trades Women's Network,
mm-hmm.
working with Connie Ashbrook from 98 to 2000, and you're currently a committee member of the African American Task Force with the Bureau of Labor and Industries, correct?
Correct, Apprenticeship Division.
Uh-huh. And you're currently the president of the caucus.
Yes, I am.
All right. So talk to us about some of your experiences in over the years and how things have changed in recruiting and mentoring and trying to help retain young black people in the trades. And
you know, I don't think that they've changed that much, Jamie. And one of the struggles that I have internally is recruiting people to an industry that is almost just as hostile today as it was 30 years ago when I entered. As I would like to build the industry and bring more people in, because I know that that's where the work happens and that's how we make change. But when I see sisters and brothers going through the same thing, I struggle with, do I want to put someone through that same pain? There has to be a change. There has to be change, and change takes time.
Now, you recently ran for the office of, was it president of the local?
Business manager.
Oh, business manager of Local 48.
Mm-hmm.
And although you didn't win the election, you spent a lot of time with a lot of people in the local, and you discovered that of about, you told me, about 400 apprentices, there were only four or five African-American.
Right.
As compared to when you were first.
20. When I
20.
Came through, there were there were five in my class.
What's happening there?
I can't explain it, but I'm working to make a change. I'm working very closely with the current leadership of the National Electrical Training Center here in Portland. We're putting in some systems. We've just hired a new workforce developer. We're going out. We're more in the community, getting the word out, selling the electrical industry as a career of choice.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'd like to hear more about the work that you're doing right now and the other people that are doing this kind of work. But first, let me remind our listeners, those of you who may have just tuned in, that you are listening to Labor Radio, KBOO, and the topic today is the Black struggle in the trades, and our guest is Donna Hammond with IBEW Local 48. Now, I heard you say, Donna, that the hostility out there is just as bad as it was 30 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And I've been surprised myself in some of the studies I've seen on racial prejudice and bigotry among Americans. Just even in the last few years, studies show that 6 out of 10 Americans harbor at least one negative stereotype about black people, whether it's that white people think that black people are lazier or less intelligent or less honest or more violent than white people. But these are stereotypes that people admit to.
Mm-hmm.
That's not even mentioning the ones that people don't admit to. So you encounter, as a young person, a black person, you come into the trades and you encounter hostility, but you don't know where it's coming from. It may be racial prejudice, it may be something else. What kind of advice do you give young people in that situation?
Well, there are several things. We go through role playing, and I ask them to develop some responses. I tell them certain things are going to happen, and so they will have a prepared response, and they don't react, and they can keep their head about them. Too often, what is perceived as a person of color's failure to handle a job is, in fact, management's failure. And so what I try to get over to these young applicants is that they have to demonstrate excellence on the job and the ability to comprehend and to do the right thing. But if they don't know the culture, if they don't understand why certain things are happening to them, they could take it personally and react, because that apprenticeship culture is different, and it's hard to explain to anyone unless you're in the middle of it. Does that make any sense?
Mm-hmm. I hear what you're saying.
So just to give them the background on what it's going to take to get through the program.
Mm-hmm.
And then we also give them phone numbers, support systems that they can use if they encounter something on the job and they need to fact check if this is appropriate, if this is okay. Help them understand what is legal, what they do have to endure during the job, what they can say no to if it's safety, and just so that they can feel comfortable. We also give them the ability to do some work outside of the job, if they need to enhance their skill sets. And so we have community service projects where they can come and hang out with other tradespeople that look like them, talk a different language, give them a little comfort in the work that they're doing. So that's also very important.
Can you talk a little bit about these pre-apprenticeship programs that have been started up or are continuing? Various right. agencies are sponsoring them.
Yeah, there are several that are moving forward in the community that's been around for several years. There's a ETAP, Evening Trades and Apprenticeship. There's a program, CAUSE. There is Irvington Covenant, CTC. And for females, well, several of these are for females also, but Oregon Tradeswomen.
Mm-hmm. And those pre-apprenticeship programs particularly reach out to young people of color and young black people.
Yes, right? Yes, they do.
Okay.
And with this this money that's coming down.
Which money are we talking about,
you
Donna?
Know, you know, that money that's just going to trickle down from Washington.
Oh, the stimulus package.
Yes, yes.
The infrastructure work.
Yes, and so there's a lot of opportunities that can be gained for people who are interested in making a very livable wage.
Mm-hmm.
These are honorable careers, and it takes the same aptitude that it takes to go to college to get into the trades. There's a lot of hard work and a lot of knowledge that's needed to get in.
So, what kind of attitudes are you finding with young people, and when you go to talk with them in schools or in other places about getting into the trades? Is the age of Obama inspiring people to get into the trades, or is there a lot of negativity? What do you experience?
You know, Obama has done a lot for our young people, and I've talked to several young brothers and sisters, and what I'm hearing is people are actually equating their day with Obama rating. You know, they will say, I'm having an Obama day if they did well in their math test or something. So I'm seeing a lot of enthusiasm. I'm seeing a lot of optimism that things are attainable.
Mm-hmm. Well, we don't have the kind of quotas systems that we used to have with affirmative action. So how is it that parity can be achieved with on these construction sites? Now, well, it sounds like we've only got maybe 1%.
Or less
black people in the construction trades. It should be at least 7% if there's parity with the number of black people in the workforce. There's no quotas aren't allowed anymore.
Right.
We like to talk about parity. How do we get there?
Well, there's a lot of work that's being done currently with the unions,
mm-hmm.
and they're putting a lot of money into diversity. Bowley is doing a lot of work. There's an African-American task force.
Mm-hmm.
There are people that are really looking at this scenario and really making inroads to that end. But we do need employers on board. And we need, you know, you can legislate, you know, job safety rules and quotas, but you can't legislate ideas. And we have to shift people's ideas about other people and try to really work through this whole racism. And there's a lot of work that's being done, and I would encourage anyone who has an opportunity to see this DVD. It's called Race, The Power of the Illusion, and how we have just been screwed and somebody has just sold us a bill of goods. And there's that subtle and conscious and unconscious racism that happens, and we need to check our biases.
You mentioned a group earlier that involves both black people and white people, and maybe people of other colors, uniting.
Oh, United to Understand Racism. Yes, UUR. I would ask your listeners if they have an opportunity to take advantage of these discussion groups. They're going on around the city of Portland. It's a 6 session. I think they're 2 hours a session. I've had 3 different encounters with this group, 3 different sessions. And each time, depending on the makeup of the group, is what you get out of it. And powerful. Just very, very, very powerful discussion. And it warms my heart, and I feel good when I'm in the room with white people, when they get it. When white people own their privilege and acknowledge, oh, you didn't realize that you were privileged just because of your skin color, that not because of anything that you've done, just because you walked in the room. And when they get that, anyway, I feel good. And that's why I like doing this work.
Mm-hmm. Is any of that happening within the trade unions?
Yes, it is.
Yes, it is.
Yes, it is.
Good to hear.
Stay tuned.
All right. So what would you say to some of our listeners who are union activists that care about, want to do something to help in this situation with more inclusion of black people in the building and construction trades? People like myself.
I would say be a mentor, be a support, and continue to encourage. I would ask you to examine a model that we use in the cultural work that I do is called the iceberg model. And looking at the 90% of the mass that's below the surface. And then when you come into contact with people, that there's 90% that you don't see. 90% of that person that you can connect with. And continue to share that with other people that look like you. Not to be put off or judge a person by that little 10% that you see above the iceberg, above the waterline, that the piece that makes us as human beings is below the surface, and that we're more alike than different. And we really need to get to that point. Everyone really needs to understand that we are so much more alike.
Great. Donna, we're almost out of time, but I want to ask you if you could just look a little bit into the future and the changes that are going to be happening in your trade with the new green jobs and the push by the Obama administration to really change the whole energy, which is electrical energy. Do you see some opportunities for our young people to really change the world here?
Yes, we can work smart, and we can reduce our footprint and save our planet.
All right. Well, that about wraps it up, folks. For Labor Radio tonight, I want to thank our guest, Donna Hammond, who is with the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers, Local 48, and a member of the African American Caucus within Local 48. Donna, I do want to give you a chance to say one last word. I can see that you have got that look on your face. Is there something you wanted to say?
I just wanted to say that, again, that I believe that the union programs have made a huge investment into diversity, and that we have a long way to go. But there are a lot of people who are really getting this. But this work takes time. And I guess the last piece that I would like to add is that the first woman was admitted into medical school. And it took, in 1888, I believe, and it took 149 years for a woman to make up 25%.
Mm-hmm.
So I just wanted to equate that to it takes time for this to happen.
So don't be discouraged.
Do not be discouraged. It's going to happen.
Thank you, Donna Hammond, our guest tonight. And I want to thank our engineer, Rebecca. This is Labor Radio. Tune in next Monday for Labor Radio and every Monday at 6 p.m. on KBOL 90.7.
was driving someone else's car. The local midnight sheriff's claim to fame. In an Arizona jail, there is some will tell the tale. I believe he fought the sergeant for some milk that he demanded. Knowing they'd remain the boss, knowing he would pay the cost, they saw he was severely reprimanded. Quite alone.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen and listeners of Prison Pipeline. I'm sure you're all ladies or gentlemen. This is Ruth Kovach bringing you Prison Pipeline and thanking you for listening. It's certainly what we call an off-the-cuff show because I never would have said that if I had a script that I was reading every word. But I welcome you. And tonight we have a call-in visitor who's going to give us an update about her brother who's been in prison a few years. And we talked to her once before, and we want to see how it's changed. But first, Mamiya Abu-Jamal.
Money changers in the temple. For readers of the Bible's New Testament, few stories illustrate the anger of Jesus of Nazareth better than that of his expulsion of the money changers from the temple. For they have, in his words, changed it into a den of thieves. This event is memorable, for it shows him not speaking in anger, but acting. Some artists have depicted him actually whipping money changers out of the temple as they flee amidst chaos. That imagery was borrowed several millennia later, when U.S. President Franklin Delano Roosevelt made his famous Fear Itself inaugural address. As the country fell under the deep freeze of depression, Roosevelt spoke words that were recognized by many of that age when he said, "The rulers of the exchange of mankind's goods have failed through their own stubbornness and their own incompetence, have admitted their failure and abdicated. Practices of the unscrupulous money changers stand indicted in the court of public opinion, rejected by the hearts and minds of men." Roosevelt continued, "The money changers have fled from their high seats in the temple of our civilization. We may now restore that temple to the ancient truths. The measure of the restoration lies in the extent to which we apply social values more noble than mere monetary profit." Those words were spoken on January 20th, 1933. That was 76 years ago. And once again, the rulers of the exchange of mankind's goods have failed, and the nation is gripped by the icy chain of depression. Yeah, I said depression. For just 6 months ago, the president assured the country that the state of the economy was sound, even as the nation was locked in a recession for most of the year. If it ain't a depression, it's a dime's distance away from it. But this ain't 33. The money changers who steered the economy onto the rocks haven't admitted defeat. They're making more money. Indeed, they are given taxpayers' money as they burn through more. The more they lose, the more they want. These money changers aren't being whipped out of the temple. They're given bigger tables. Look at AIG, Goldman Sachs, Citigroup. Not just Mo Money, but Mo, and Mo Money. Because in the eyes of Washington and the Federal Reserve, they're too big to fail. Under that illogic, they will swallow the moon and get bigger while the nation's economy worsens by the hour. Welcome to the Temple of Thieves. From Death Row, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal. These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio.
Thank you, Mumia. Always words of wisdom. I have Debbie on the line. Hello, Debbie.
Hi, Ruth.
It's nice. So good for you to call.
Thank you. Nice to talk to you again.
We're going
to
do a little update about your brother that I'm sure will interest our listeners. And before we start, I have a poem I wanted to share with you and the listeners because it's so appropriate to what we have to talk about.
Okay,
here we go. This is called Just Visiting. It's from the Cell Block Poetry Book published by Shot Caller Press. And the writer is Andrea Walker, who I happen to know is the mother of a son that's been in prison for quite a few years. Each cold gray Saturday leads to the next. Get up early, dress warm, comfortable, and modest. Drive 3 hours through Georgia backwoods. Park, empty pockets except for the ID picture, and the plastic Ziploc bag that holds $20 worth of quarters. Get out of the car and stretch. Apply lipstick, pop gum for clean breath, and then spit it out when told. Stretch again and breathe deeply the fresh free air stealing ourselves for the assault of our individuality, privacy, and esteem. Now we line up, sign in, show the ID. Next we walk through the metal telltale. Back up, slip out of the shoes, the belts, the jewelry, and try the tattletale again. Wait to be told where to sit. Wait some more, 5 minutes to 30 minutes. He walks through the door, and his smile warms our soul, and his hug warms our heart. Isn't that lovely, Debbie?
Yes, it is.
I mean, it's just, it just glows with someone who's been there visiting, and I know you've been visiting your brother for quite some time, so let's get a little update on him. How long was he sentenced to?
He was sentenced for 72 months.
Is that about 8 years?
It's a little over 8 years. We've gotten close to just about the halfway mark. We're a little short of the halfway mark still, but getting close to the halfway mark.
Now, I interviewed you shortly after he was in. In fact, that was my first visit to a prison, was to go visit your brother with you. He's just one nice guy, and I was so glad I went. And I'm wondering, did you try to get that 8 years reduced?
Well, he's actually been sentenced under a Measure 11 mandatory minimum sentencing law, so there isn't anything to get reduced. Mm-hmm. There's no good time to be had with Measure 11 crimes that you're sentenced with, so there really isn't anywhere to go with that. We did put in appeals. They were denied. Right now, the last appeal we're working on, which is actually at the Supreme Court, is for his post-prison sentencing.
So for almost 4 years, you have continued to be occupied with the time and energy it takes to work with legal lawyers and in the system, and you've been spending money. Have you spent $1,000 yet?
Oh, we've spent, I'm sure, a lot more than $1,000 at this point.
Uh-huh.
My mom puts $50 a month on his phone. I usually try to put somewhere between $25 and $50 on his books when I can. Sometimes it's once a month, sometimes it's every couple months, just kind of whatever we can afford, as other family members do the same.
Mm-hmm. And you visit him once a month. What does that cost when you go visit him?
Well, we do visit him once a month, and that well, it's a 3.5 hour drive each way. So, you know, with gas prices right now, if we make it a day trip, it's a good $50 or more, $50-$60, including lunch, gas. If you spend the night, that's going to be another $60-$70 for the night, getting a hotel.
And an extra meal, the breakfast and the supper, right?
Yes.
And for that, you get to see him a couple times, a couple hours each, and that's about it. And I'm trying to add it in my head. So in addition to this money that you regularly send, there's another $100 a month just to go visit him once in a while.
Right.
Well, you think it's worth it? I mean, if it costs double that, would you go anyway?
I sure would.
Well, we all know that, but I want you to have a chance to say it.
Of course I would. It's, I mean, there's times when it's everything we can do just to scratch up money to go, but it sure does make you feel good to do it. Mm-hmm. And I know that it means the world to him, and that's the most important thing.
Well, you're doing everything you can for him. What's he doing to keep you so strong and so full of faith? Is he staying out of the hole?
He is. I guess we kind of try to feed off each other's strength. He's actually has a really good attitude, and that really kind of keeps us going, too.
Uh-huh. Has he accepted it, that it's going to be the full 8 years?
Yes, I believe he has.
Yeah, I don't think he accepted it the first year, did he? He kept hoping something had happened that it wouldn't really happen. Yeah, you just couldn't believe it was really going to happen.
Right.
And what about the time that he has in there? Is he using that? Is he in any rehab programs or a work program?
He does work. He works in the kitchen. He makes, I believe, around $43 a month working in the kitchen. He has completed his GED while he's been in there.
Well, that's good.
He's taken some computer typing classes while he's in there. And I send him books. He reads. And
okay.
Works out every day.
Well, is he in any kind of attitude rehab program that gives him the strength? Is he in a drug rehab program or anything like that?
He hasn't been involved in anything like that yet. From what I understand at the facility he's in, they don't actually have a lot of those types of facilities there for them. They've said that when he gets on shorter time that he may be transferred to another facility that would have more of those to offer.
Well, getting the GED was a good step, and the computer programs is something.
Right.
And is he making any friends?
Yes, he has friends. And when he loses a cellie, he generally has others that ask to be celled with him, and that seems to work out pretty
good. Uh-huh. Well, when you're with someone 24/7, it's nice if you can get along with each other.
Right.
Is this an integrated prison, or do they keep the races segregated?
They don't. Well, what they keep segregated is the gangs.
I see.
So they do try to limit gang activity. They do try to find out who the known gang members are, and pretty much keep them separate. So
they don't put opposing gang members as cellmates. Uh-huh.
No.
Right. Well, that sounds like the right thing to do.
Right. And the yards are small there. There's about 100 people per unit, and they have small yards. Not a lot of people go to the yards. They're small, and it also cuts down a lot on some of the violent activity.
Mm-hmm. How much yard time do they get?
They go for a couple hours a day.
Uh-huh.
And
if they wanted to take advantage of every minute of it, they could be in the yard a few hours a day.
Mm-hmm.
And then my understanding at the other prisons that I've been volunteering and working at is that when something like, for instance, the writing class I do down at Oregon State Prison and a few other things I've been to, these activities that are kind of goodies or treats for the prisoners often take place during yard time, and the prisoner has to choose between his yard time and this activity. Has that happened for him, or you don't know?
No, I haven't heard of that happening so much. One of the things that they do where he's located is that they do have movie nights. So if you're at a certain level, you are able to go watch certain movies that they might bring in, some of the newer movies. So he does get a chance to do that as kind of a special treat, I guess mm-hmm. you'd say.
And is there kind of a relaxing room that instead of yard time where they sit around and visit or play cards?
There's what's called the day room, and it has a TV for those that don't have TVs or if they just want to go watch TV with everybody else. Maybe there's a race on or something.
Mm-hmm.
They can go to the day room and watch the TV. And some of the folks, like my brother in particular, has a TV in his cell. He's actually on his second TV there. The first one died on him, so uh-huh. we had to scrape together the funds to help him out to get another.
Oh, they don't furnish that, I'm sure.
No, your family pays for that
uh-huh.
for you.
Your family pays for a lot of things. I can't get over the things you have to pay for in toiletries, for instance.
Uh-huh.
And I've also met a lot of prisoners who... I've learned a lot since the first time I went to visit him with you.
Mm-hmm.
And I've met a lot of prisoners who either aren't satisfied, they don't get filled up, or they don't like it. But the regular meals are legally adequate,
mm-hmm.
but they really like to have a few extra coins to go to that machine and get out. Anything from a candy bar to a soup mix to whatever. Does he do that sometimes, too?
He does. He orders things from the commissary. But you really have to kind of prioritize when you don't have a lot of money what it is that you really need. You have to buy your own tennis shoes and boots if you don't want to wear the plastic shoes that they give you. And so... he has to buy, you know, and the shoes cost as much as they do out here, of course. You know, they're $50, $60
really?
For a pair of tennis shoes.
Which is more than a week's pay for him. It's more than a month's pay, isn't
right.
it?
Right, it's more than a month's pay.
Uh-huh.
And
so his savings account, let's see, at $40 a month for 70 months, he could come out with several thousand dollars, but the bottom line is he'll be lucky to break even. Is that about right?
Right. He barely makes it each month, and we try to help him out. He's taking some vitamins right now. He is found out since he's been in there that he has hepatitis C.
Really? That's so sorry to hear that.
Yeah. It was a sad thing to find out. And so one of the things that he's been trying to do is to keep the enzyme levels down by taking certain vitamins, and of course those cost, you know, a pretty penny too in there. They're anywhere from $8 up to $16, $17, $18 a bottle, just like out here.
Hmm.
And so he's been trying to control it with that. However, his levels have been going up and he's getting concerned. And so we're really hoping that, and he's going to try to get treatment while he's in there. And that's what we're pushing for right now, is for that treatment. Hmm. To come about. So
it sounds to me like he's not an extravagant guy. He's not spending his money on all the goodies he could get if he had the money. And he still uses up the $40 he earns and the $50 you send every month, and hopes that he has enough for the next month for some of the things, such as shoes and toiletries, that are really necessities.
Right.
Uh-huh. Well, you know, if someone has a loved one in prison, maybe you love them enough to be like you and your mother are, a mother, a sister, a wife, or a husband, and you make these regular contributions. But maybe you were just good friends and you're kind of empathetic, if not sympathetic. It would really be a good idea to send as little as $10. Can they show up and visit him and give him $10?
No, you actually have to send the money into Salem through the mail with a money order, and then they put it on their books for them. And the same with the phone. The phone, you fill out a money order and you send it to Texas. And sometimes that takes well over a week to get put onto the phone. So
no, he's not in Texas and he's not in Salem. So, again, we have a little time lag here. You make a decision and you send it. It doesn't mean he's going to benefit from it the next day.
Right. Yeah, we try to stay ahead of it as much as we can. And he tries to, you know, we ask him, you know, what his needs are and how he's doing on his phone and, you know, what he's going to be needing. And we try to do as best as we can staying ahead of it so that he doesn't have to go without.
Well, is he a reader? What about books?
He does read, and I've sent him many, many, many books. I order them out off of Amazon. And actually, for anybody that's familiar with FAM, it's Families Against Mandatory Minimum Sentencing. They're based in Washington. They actually have a site that you can go on to and order the books, and a little bit of money goes to them, too. So that's kind of nice.
Because, again, just like with bringing a $10 bill, you can't just bring them a book when you go visit.
No, you have to do, that has to be sent from a publisher or somebody like Amazon.
Really?
Yes. And so that's usually, you know, at least $20 each time a book goes out with shipping and handling in the book, and it's usually a brand new book.
Well, while we're on the subject of books, I have a good one to recommend. You know, Mamiya Abu-Jamal has just finished his newest book, and on his birthday, April 24th, will be the official release date of a book by Mamiya called Jailhouse Lawyers. Mm-hmm. And it's about 300 pages, and Mamiya tells not only about how to be a jailhouse lawyer and what the work they do is, but the history of jailhouse lawyers and the history of a prisoner's right to defend himself in court, because they didn't always have that right. So that should be a very good book if you are looking for something new to send to your brother or someone else wants to send to their loved one. Mm-hmm. Mamiya Abu-Jamal's book, Jailhouse Lawyer, is going to be available on April 24th. And I'm sure if you search the web, you can find out how to go to City Lights Publishing Company and send them a check, and they'll send the book to your prisoner person.
I would love to do that.
Yeah, I think this is going to be a great book. We're going to have an event here in Portland at Bread and Roses, and we're going to have a book review, and several people will read excerpts from the book, and we'll have some books there that we can sell. And so folks on the outside that just want to buy the book for themselves could show up at Bread and Roses on April 24th and have access to that book, plus hearing a review. I'll be doing the main review, and then there'll be other people reading excerpts from it. So.
Very good.
The other little thing, you know, I'm always doing something. Shot Caller Press published the Cell Block Poetry that I just read, that poem by Andrea Walker from. And they've been running a tattoo art contest. And I got a message from Teresa Huggins, the CEO and founder of Shot Caller Press. And she says, I wanted to let you all know that the prison tattoo art contest is going well. We've received many fine drawings, some too awesome to express with words. But we would like, however, to see more entries. So I'm hoping that you could help us spread the word and pass this information to others. The contest is for prison tattoo-style art. Prisoners and ex-prisoners are qualified to enter. The prizes include $250, $150, and $75, including a possibility of being published. The deadline for this contest is May 31st. So anyone out there who's a tattoo artist that has been thinking of sending it in, you need to contact Shot Caller Press. You can go on the web to www.shotcallerpress.com, or you can probably easily find out just how to send your entry in. There's plenty of applications out there. I didn't mean to interrupt our conversation with that, but I keep thinking of things prisoner can do. They seem... The prizes of $250 is very appealing to some of the folks there, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So are you meeting other families that are regular visitors to their people there?
Yes. We see the same people all the time.
The same ones, uh-huh.
Sure. I mean, some new, but mostly we do see the same folks.
How many prisoners get visitors? Half of them?
I don't know. I would say that on a given day that we go on a Saturday, there's probably 30 visitors that come in.
And how many people in that prison? Thousands?
There's probably about 1,200.
1,200.
Mm-hmm.
And 30 people get visitors, and it's right. The same. And Saturday's the big visiting day, so
right.
Let's see, 7 days a week, 7 times 3 is 21. If 200 of the 1,200 get visitors, that would be a lot.
Right.
And you're not there every Saturday. You're there
no.
once a month.
Exactly.
So in a given week, maybe a couple hundred people. You know, how about that 1,000 other guys? Doesn't anyone out there know or love someone who's in lockdown well enough to go visit them twice a year? You know, would that be too much? And you want to say, yeah, it's too much. It costs us over $100, and there's got to be some love there.
Mm-hmm.
But I just have to throw that out there. That
Right. And a lot of people's folks are elderly or gone, you know. I mean, there's so many different situations.
And health problems make
it
difficult.
Health problems.
Mm-hmm.
Some of these facilities are a long ways away. And it's just really tough on people to get there.
Well, more often than not, it's more than an hour's drive.
Oh, sure.
I know of one woman who loves her son dearly, and he's in another state, and round-trip plane tickets, a couple hundred dollars, and she only goes 3-4 times a year because that's all she can afford to go see him.
And I'm sure it breaks her heart.
Oh, yes. So, you know, when I first was talking to you and your mother was standing in the mall passing out flyers about how wrong this is and how right that is and what people can do. Does she still do that?
She doesn't do it so much anymore. She used to actually go down to the courthouse and do that, and it just got to be kind of depressing, I guess, to do that and for her. And it just, you know, it really kind of does wear you out sometimes.
Yeah, it's fair to say you burn out when you're trying to do that work.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
And also when you're passing out flyers, at first it's so obvious to you that things are so wrong, and all you need to do is tell someone, look, this is what's wrong, and here's what we have to do. And they'll say, oh, for crying out loud, yes, I'll help you. And instead they kind of look at you with disdain and throw the flyer on the floor, and it's not an easy job.
No, it's not. And, you know, the Partnership for Safety and Justice that I'm involved in, when I know how many incarcerated folks are in Oregon, I just wish I could see so many more of the family members involved in some of these programs, because I know how much it's helped me and my mom get through this, that I know how beneficial it would be to others if they could be involved in some of these groups like CURE and Partnership.
So you don't just do it for the prisoner that you love. You do it for yourselves, too. It really is. Now, let's see. We said Partnerships for Safety and Justice. We said CURE, C-U-R-E. And I've mentioned some of the transitional programs like Phoenix Rising Transitions and Seventh Step and Uhuru Sasa. There are quite a few organizations that function in the prison and out of the prison. And the way to start is go to Google and put in prisoners, Oregon, and then put in visitors, put in organizations, put in helping hands. And there are many organizations that show up. I like to tell that when I went to Oakland, California in September, there were over 3,000 people at that gathering. And each of them represented organizations that are doing things, trying to reform prisons and trying to help the prisoners.
Mm-hmm.
So for the prisoners and the families who feel very much alone most of the time, I want to emphasize once again, there are thousands of folks out there working on these issues who are very concerned.
Yeah.
But the fact is, most of them have someone who's in lockdown. And it's the old story, until you've been there, you just don't get it.
That's true.
Well, Debbie, it's been good to talk to you. I don't think your situation is anything to be envied, but it sounds like you're hanging in there, you're coping. You continue to be full of hope. Your brother continues to be strong and keep well.
Yeah.
And I certainly wish you both well. And I'm really running over time, so I'm going to have to say goodnight. And thanks again for calling
Thank
me.
Thank you, Ruth, and for all you do.
Night now.
And night.
Okay, and to my listeners, thank you for listening. Thank you to Cable for being a free speech radio place where I can say whatever I want to say and tell the truth that they don't want you to hear. Thank you to Rebecca, the engineer who works miracles here. No matter what I do, she seems to know which little button to press to make the program come off and work well. So keep in touch with your loved ones. Write to them, call them, visit them, send them a book, and be tuned in next week for Prison Pipeline. Good night.
Some will tell the tale. A Billy fought the sergeant for some milk that he demanded. Knowing they'd remain the boss, knowing he would pay the cost, they saw he was severely reprimanded. Take me home. Come and lay, help us lay young Billy down.